Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I'm very heartened that people are so attentive to my instruction. It's really quite encouraging, because I'll just say like a couple of phrases and then people will pick up on it and use it. So lovely to see that people are interested and focused, and so that's gratifying. I'm not sure, you can never tell, but I think I'm pretty economical with the teaching, because I think that's more effective. So if you're a meditation teacher and you discourse for 10 minutes on what people should be doing, I don't think you're teaching meditation. You're giving a lecture. So just my suggestion, because I think what's really effective is just like one word, bang. Anyway, that's my opinion. It's a good story. But please, can you, okay, we start the talk now. Cut that out. I do walk away from some of these recordings thinking, oh, if he or she, and I don't want to gossip, right? You have a story and it comes out. Anyway, here we are. Someone asked me about the story about Tisser, and I don't know if that's going to be interesting. Just very quickly, so I've been involved in creating monasteries, and at some point in my life I said, if I ever have the idea to start a monastery, take me out back and shoot me. But anyway, it's a lot of work, I tell you. When my mom took ill, I went to Ottawa, and after I think 4 years with her, I started to think that what am I going to do after she passes away? And I realized I really kind of like being in Ontario. I like being with people who are in my culture, and I like speaking English. You know, I really like being back in Canada. And so, I didn't feel like going to Europe, or didn't want to be in Asia, didn't want to speak a foreign language. So then I thought, well, maybe we should start a monastery. Perish the thought. And then I asked the friends in the OBS, and I said, what do you think? You think there'll be interest? People said, probably. So I called a meeting, and I think 60 or 70 people came. So I said, is anyone interested? And people were very positive. I said, okay, it's going to cost money. Pretty soon we started to search for land. It wasn't much longer after that. And so I just drew a circle from Ottawa, hour and a half drive away, towards Toronto. That was my criteria for searching. Compass, and looked around. And a lot of the vacant land was just hunt land and had a horrible feeling to it. Just really abused land and abused animals, didn't like. And then we came across this property, and looked good. And the best thing was it was loved. It had big trees, and the couple that owned it, the rodenbushes, they really loved the land. And I think we all felt that quite deeply. And it was big enough, had a house, had water. So we said, let's go for it. It was interesting, we didn't have a penny. We weren't even the OBS, we were just whatever. And so no bank was going to lend money to us. And I think commercial interest rates were like 11%, something crazy. So we just put out, Philip had a brilliant idea. Well, why don't we just ask for loans that we would that we'd pay interest on? I think we had promised 5%, was it?
5%?
For 5 years. So we put out the call, and within a few months we had the money for the buying land, which was, and then we paid it off within a couple of years. Yeah. So, and we don't believe in debt, right? But how do you start? So that was the kind of thing that we don't usually do. But people are very generous, and actually some people, who I think at that time there's also that kind of money crash thing, and some people said because they put it in the monastery they didn't lose money in the market. That make me feel good. Anyway, so then for the next 5 years, I guess, I would go, and then first year, Tina was there, Marion was there. Marion Foote was the first abbess. She was on the committee. She stayed there, and then Stephen came and did work, and people came. We started to get the place together, and then Ajahn Kuslo came. And then he's a very, very good friend from New Zealand. And he became the first senior monk, incumbent. And he got cancer. And he already had it coming from Australia. So within the first year and a half, he was being treated for cancer. Which was successful treatment. His therapy was to get on the tractor. We had this old tractor, and he'd, oh, heck with this lying around stuff. I'm getting on the tractor. So he's going through chemotherapy, but starting the monastery. He's a intrepid man. He's really, his energy is quite phenomenal. And we're good friends. So then I would come every weekend. I would leave Mom on the Saturday morning, and then come have the dana at Tisarana, and then stay until the dana next day, and then go back to be with Mom. And did that for 5 years. So I got to know that road very well. Mm-hmm. And almost probably every Sunday on the way back, I'd get the driver to stop at the Loblaws. What's it called? It's not Loblaws. It's that other name for Loblaws now. Independent store in the Carlton Place, across from the Tim Hortons and the Starbucks. And I'd get flowers. And then because Mom loves flowers. And then every Sunday, I would return four-ish. She'd be obviously really waiting for me. And I'd have the flowers behind my back. Ta-da! And she was so happy. And then I'd use that happiness as my object of meditation. You know, just to kind of make that conscious. Because I would look at her face. And that's what mudita is about. You know, mudita is that joy that we can feel at another person's joy. That's a beautiful human quality, isn't it? You know, when I see someone who is successful or happy, and I say, oh, yeah, that's good. So just seeing Mom happy, because like the sense world for a 90-year-old isn't all that much fun. So sense experience is very, it's a bummer, to say the least. It's very negative. And so I I realized with her that what I needed, what would be good to do, was to not be a monk. And but actually, I stayed a monk with her, but to try to create beauty and color and something which would bring her mind to brightness, because of the sense experience was lots of pain, osteoarthritis, all that kind of stuff, and body shrinking, and legally blind, macular degeneration, you know, the whole nine yards when you're over 90. So the sense experience is not great. So, like one of the really lovely stories I like to tell, she, my mother was a very fashionable woman. She never wore trousers in her life. Born in 1915, quite a wealthy family. Loved fashion, just loved fashion. Hated the shoes that old people had to wear. She was a real Prada lady. So, you know, her feet were always swollen, so she had these clunky shoes, she hated them. But so I got her a subscription to two German magazines, Stern and, not Spiegel, the other one, I forget which one. Anyway, it had a lot of women's fashion in it. And she just loved that. Even though she was legally blind, somehow she would kind of get her eyeballs over here. She loved, she'd just go through it. And then what I tried to do with her was I tried to keep her informed about something weird in modern culture. And just to, you know, because that's what, like, elderly people, they're really declining very quickly. And mentally, I saw that I had to, if I could keep her interested in things. So I always look for weird things in culture. And then, you know who came on the scene? Lady Gaga. And I thought, perfect. Anyone who calls themselves Lady Gaga is going to be interesting. And sure enough, Lady Gaga? You know, and I kind of explained who this person was, and whenever there was a picture, I tried to show her. And then she came that one time where she wore the meat dress. Did you hear about that? That was great. There was some kind of protest about meat eating. And she had a dress stitched together of steaks. And on her head, she had a little toupee of a steak. It was the most outrageous thing. It was great. Hey, Mom, look what Lady Gaga's done. And sure enough, the following month when that came through, there was, in the fashion magazine, Lady Gaga in her steak dress. So anyway, that's what I... So much of my time was like taking up these esoteric practices with my mom. So that, you know, that was all going on as we're starting the monastery. So for me, taking care of my mom was like 9 years of Brahmavihara practice. You know, the Brahmaviharas that we chant, the shower chant that we do. 9 years of that. And because I was very close to my mom, like I tell people, we had one disagreement in 9 years, which lasted 20 minutes. So, pretty good deal. So for 9 years, I had this opportunity of serving and helping and loving and so on, and that's going to be very, very profound. And it was exhausting in some way, but not really, because, you know, if you're coming from that space, you can do a lot. You can do so much. And the tiredness is just tiredness. It's not... Well, you can't do a lot is when you resent it. When it's a duty, then you can't do it. You know, you last a day. So it was kind of perfect situation. When other people ask me, and I find out, well, their parents are very, like, hurt them as children, or that's different. You can't do this if that relationship's not there. So it would be unreasonable to ask people to do this. So anyway, so during that time, I just go back and forth, and then Yeah, and then Mom died in 2011, and then my brother said, okay, go back to the monastery. And he sorted all that stuff out. And so I've been there since 2011. And here we are. That's kind of the story. And then we have good young monks of middle age. Are you middle aged? You're some age, middle aged. Monks coming, and well, we have an 19-year-old from Michigan who's just ordaining, really very mature guy. I'm very reluctant to take someone, you know, I'm always afraid someone's coming from their parents' basement into my basement. I just... very wary of that. But he's great. He's got a really good work ethic and really good. So that's very rewarding to be able to create a place where a young man can, who have that inclination, can go forth. And it can never be many, because many aren't interested. Plus, we just don't have that kind of culture and society. But just, you know, to offer that. Because if you don't have a place where young men who have a spiritual inclination can't follow that, then that important part of men's development is not addressed in society, and it's a huge loss. It's a huge loss. Because then it can get kind of... Well, if you have someone like that and you can nurture them and help them, then they become... leaders of the spiritual community, even if they say nothing, you know, even if they say nothing. So that's always been like, in terms of social activism, over the years I've realized that's my mode of social activism, is to try to create sanctuary for lay people, animals, and also a place where community is a real thing, not a virtual community. We were talking about that in one of the interview groups, where, you know, people really love community, and it's become a kind of like the community of bloggers. I mean, what's that? Okay, so it's a bunch of people sending each other emails, but it's different, isn't it? When you were actually living with people and you have a common aspiration. So I realized I didn't sign up for this, right? But I realized that's a form of social activism, which kind of, in my stage of life, that's what I think guys my age might think about. It's very rewarding in that sense. And it's got a great workshop. So I'm doing all right. So I am glad I started it. Sometimes I have had times where I've had, like, you know, difficult communities. I think, God, why did you start this? You could have retired. But all of life is like that, isn't it? Why did I get married? A monastery is really an archetype, and so is the monk and nun. They're kind of archetypes in culture, which represents spiritual aspiration, and not everyone has the vocation to be a monastic, and not everyone has the opportunity to be a monastic, and you can only build so many monasteries. But if we don't have in our culture archetypes of spiritual aspiration, like this place, and places where those values are kept, our society is deeply impoverished, isn't it? Deeply impoverished. And because we have those potentials and we have those yearnings, there have to be places and opportunities where that can flower and be expressed. So this place is beautiful, and the monastery and OBS, you know, that we all do. And it's a huge service to society. It's not recognized. You know, what's recognized is some startup that makes another cell phone. Oh, great. you know, or what Apple just put out, XS or something, right? You really need another Apple telephone. And yet, the world goes crazy about it. It's daft, isn't it? Absolutely daft. So, you know, these are, like, especially people know BS, really be encouraged in the work you do. It's important. It's important. It doesn't seem like much. So as an archetype, like in using the physical realm to realize spiritual goals, what I think one of the impoverishments of our society is that it's so secular. So even like people even to use the word religion, they feel they don't want to use the word religion. You say, I'm a Buddhist, but I'm not religious. So even the language of whatever spirituality is hard to kind of get going. So it can sound, it can be left at the level of psychology, but there's more to Buddhism than psychology. There's more to Christianity than psychology. There's more to Islamic mysticism, to Rumi say, than psychology, isn't there? What are these beings realized? So I like to read Rumi. I don't know where he's at half the time. I know he's not drunk. I know his elixir is love, but just the reading of that is uplifting, isn't it? You know that there are beings who aspire to whatever their spiritual goal is. So say in Theravada Buddhism, like we have a shrine, you know, and how do you use a shrine? Well, again, it's symbols, and the Buddha image is kind of archetype of liberation. So if you ever get a Buddha rupa, then you wanna treat that as a symbol rather than objet d'art. Objet d'art is just for sense pleasure that you can, you know, show off to your people that come to your cocktail parties or whatever. Or it's something you have on the mantelpiece with a, you know, a carving of a beaver or something. But you want to elevate symbology, don't you? You want to have, like, if you have a tanka, do you really want to put it next to a picture of Marilyn Monroe? Probably not. You have a tanka or a Buddha, you want to separate it, you want to create something beautiful. So like a Buddha image, you don't want it on the floor. You want to elevate it, you want to get it up, you want to give it some status. Huh? And then you want to kind of maybe dust it. That'd be a radical thing, huh? Which means you actually have to look at it. Right? So if it's an object d'art, you dust it with all the other object d'arts it depends how often you dust. But if it's a symbol, then how do you uplift it? How do you kind of use it as something that raises you up? Well, you put it in a special corner, and then you might flowers. That's a good idea. You might take some flowers and a vase, and you might actually change the water every now and then. Or you could just plunk some plastic flowers and forget about it. You do that. But then it just becomes another thing in your room. There's the couch and there's the plastic flowers of the Buddha and you walk by. Whereas devotion, you know, devotion is this use of symbology. And because what our culture is also very starved of is like devotion. We're such a cynical culture and frightened. And Venerable Amarasiri's culture and Raji's culture has so much devotion in it, bhakti, which is a quality that I think probably in Western culture goes into evangelical type of religions, you know, that have a kind of bhakti flavor to them. Most of us that come to Buddhism from our backgrounds come to it from a kind of critical, psychological background. But, and there are books, of course, that say, you know, that even dismiss rebirth or try to dumb it down to a modern type of therapy, which is tragic. I think it's tragic. So the idea of imagery and devotion is to try to, what is it in our heart when we, say some of you might have heard the Dalai Lama speak, been to one of his talks. I mean, the being is so uplifting. He's just so utterly uplifting, right? And that's not him, that's you. That's your heart. He does it, but you're doing it, aren't you? And so how do you bring that sense of uplift into spiritual life rather than it being like Ajahn Sumedho says, brain surgery without anesthesia? That's what this can feel like. Oh God, another hour. You know, and it won't work. You know, how do you bring uplift and joy into it? Well, imagery can do that, but you have to invest time into that. So you do weird things like bowing and chanting, and that takes time. You have to invest time into it. So as I joke, like after a retreat, it sounds like the last day of the retreat, doesn't it? But after a retreat, you know, people will say, yeah, I'm going to go for it. Yeah. Hour every day, two, 3 hours every day. Right? All right? Okay. Hour and a half first day. Then the negotiating starts. Half an hour. And then, like I joke, and then 6 months later, you're waving at the Buddha image. You go to work. So there's quality time and there's quantity time too. You have to do quantity time. You can't just do whatever you do. Yeah, you have to put the time into it. But the rewards are great. So if you actually create a shrine and you make it special in your house, and you make it a special corner, a corner that's always cared for and that has your zafu there, and you have the shrine, and you, like the Tibetans, they offer water to the shrine. If you've been to Bodh Gaya, you'll see these offering tables with maybe like 1,000 cups of water. You imagine the woman that did that. She took they're little tiny things, you know, they're smaller than that. She filled 1,000 of those, placed them on a ledge, and was thinking of the Buddha when she did that. She probably doesn't have to watch the breath because she's going to get it filled with devotion. So that, you know, there are ways of touching the heart which are not so kind of intellectual. And art is one of the ways. Art, iconography, these are very beautiful ways. So like this Buddha image is very, very touching, isn't it? It's lovely. But once you get into it, any old Buddha will do, really. A crooked-nosed Buddha, it's all right. So you don't want to be an aesthete. You know, this is like, again, we look at Buddha image as objet d'art, and you kind of, oh, look at the hairpiece on that. That's so disappointing. And so we're not really using it as a symbol. We're just into artistic twaddle. That's what Westerners do, right? But if you are using, I mean, obviously, I like a Buddha, a beautiful Buddha too, and all the room, I have some beautiful Buddhas in my room, and the ones I don't like are out in the hallway. Truth be told, confessions of a aesthete monk. But the idea, of course, is that when you look at the Buddha image, you stop the mind. Or if you look at a stupa, you stop the mind and you come to the knowing. Oh, it's this way. So even if you feel critical about the shape of the Buddha image, then you go right there, oh, this is what criticism feels like. And so then the image awakens you. That's the idea, isn't it? And then, of course, you're trying to transfer that to all things, that all things are. All things point to awakening. This is the very curious thing. Even anger points to awakening. And that's the suggestion I've been making, and I'm impressed at how many people are going to give it a go, of kind of picking up some aspect of your conditioning and using that as the thing you're going to awaken to. And I've been warning people, don't try to fix it. So the project I've been suggesting was around anger, and other people say, well, I'll try worry or whatever. But so I was saying irritation, annoyance, aversion, anger, and rage. Okay, so we said, listen, there's a nice spectrum of 50% of your day, or whatever percentage is. Now, so my suggestion is to use that like you use the Buddha Rupa. You look at the Buddha Rupa, and what does it mean? Awake. Oh, awake. All right? It's easier with the Buddha Rupa, but even that we forget. Now do that with something that's really troublesome, like aversion. So aversion arises, and rather than try to fix it, that's not the project. Project is to awaken to aversion feeling this way. Huh? So all that which has plagued you becomes that which in awakens you. And then just trust that that awake mind will sort it out for you. But I think what people can mishear this suggestion or misread it and then think, okay, I'm going to work, you know, this idea of I'm going to work with, or awakening isn't work. Right? So then there's the idea, I'm going to work with this energy, and I'm going to work with this, and I work with that. And who's the worker? Anyway, who is this worker? There is no worker. There's just anger. Right? So that kind of I think industrious but misguided notion, I'm going to work with my anger, puts you in a kind of, not necessarily, but it can put you in a space where you think you're going to get rid of anger. You're going to be disappointed. But if you awaken to anger, then it'll arise and cease, and your home will become more pronounced as being awareness itself. And there's a different slant on that, right? So you go away from the street, I'm going to really work on my anger. It's better. Yeah, don't kick the cat, all right? And don't swear at the neighbors, right? I mean, but most of us know how to do that. Right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But my suggestion is slightly more subtle. So this idea of like working with, working that, it's okay, but I would suggest just awakening to the way things are. And then there's no work to do. That's the punchline. And once you understand that, it's like this. There is actually nothing you have to do, and it's the very having to do something about that you get caught up in the whole self-making, I-making, my-making. Socially, yeah, you have to do things. You know, you have to make breakfast, and you have to go to work, or you have to make sure your pension plan is topped up. However, does one top up a pension plan? I don't know how these things happen, but anyway, you have to do that, sure. But this way, the awakened mind is already your home ground, and it's the trust in that that I think is crucial. Whereas what we've been conditioned to quite often is, I want to be a good person, and to be a good person, I have to work on my anger because I have an anger problem, right? And because I have an anger problem, blah, 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 I'm going to work on it. So then we get angry. And then what do? We have the feeling, oh, God, I'm not getting anywhere in my practice. And then we hate ourselves. And then we compound the whole problem. Okay, I'm really try now. I'm going to try to talk to Betty in a really nice way. Betty gets up my nose. I hate you, Betty. Oh, boy. And you know, it just doesn't work. Is there a Betty in the crowd? I hope not. But what does work is taking responsibility And then awakening and abiding in that space rather than attaching to the object. It does work. You need a lot of patience for that. And you kind of have to get out of the way, don't you? Just let anger be what it is, and yet live morally. Don't hurt people. Practice right speech. Be gentle, be compassionate. Those are helpful things. But when it arises, what would getting out of the way mean? It's just allowing anger to be just what it is. So Ajahn Sumedho's statement that it's like this and it all belongs. It's a very profound, that statement. It's very, very profound. It all belongs. Some people don't like that because they read it as a condoning of negative energies, but that's just a reading of it. But what it's implying is that all belongs is what love is about. And love isn't just about me loving the people I like and so on. It's not even an emotion in that sense. If you take it in a spiritual sense, it's not really an emotion. It's an expansive space, isn't it? Yeah, of awareness and acceptance. So when the heart then picks up on that, and there is the arising of anger, and then there's a statement, on this belongs, then what you're doing, you're moving consciousness in a way of love rather than aversion, you see? Whereas the other is, now I'm going to really work on my anger. You're moving it towards self, me having an anger problem. That's just, I don't think that works. I mean, it does work to a certain extent. You know, that's where I think therapies come in. People start to take responsibility, and those are brilliant. But at some point, and that's hopefully, that's what we're doing, we're seeing, well, that's a movement, but there's a bigger picture than psychology. So we need to get our hearts into this space where we can do this. As I said earlier, people who are really, really damaged can't do this. They have to do that kind of work first, I think, and then they can come to this. I was very fortunate. I had good parents. Really good parents. Well, that's the story of Tisserna. Let me see. Let me just. You got time? Can you say something about how to deal with being the object of someone's irritation and anger? How do we bring about understanding, compassion, forgiveness, and when do we know when it's time to avoid them? Yeah. Well, if they're toxic, avoid them. Don't try to be Jesus or try to be a martyr or save everyone. Right? That's not going to work. So I think the how much toxicity can you bear is a good question. If you have a choice, sometimes you have no choice. But if you have a choice, I think the litmus test is the toxicity something that gives you strength to move towards equanimity, or is the toxicity making you toxic? And if that's the case, get yourself out of there, because you're just getting weaker. You can only help other people if you're strong enough. And some, you can be very naive and think, I'll save this person, and you drown with them. So I think the test is, like, if you're doing meditation every day, and then every day you're monitoring the results of the past few days, because they're coming up. And if your mind is just like going into weeping quickly or stressed out, then this person is someone that is, their problems are bigger than you. But having said that, if you can remain equanimous and there is an opening, and you can get them to be conscious of their anger, okay, great, sadhu, good on you, but know your limits, right? So how do we bring about understanding, compassion, forgiveness? Well, you can only do it in your own heart. If I want you to forgive me, You might or might not. I can do it in my heart, right? But even like forgiveness, you kind of make that a project. But first of all, start with, well, actually, I don't want to forgive. Thank you very much. Begin with honesty, right? Because if you overlay, like someone's really done you a bad turn, and then, you know, you have your kind of conditioning that you should, and actually what you'd like to do is strangle them. You got to be honest with that and say, well, no, actually, I don't really feel like forgiving this person right now. I feel like strangling them. Oh, and this is what it feels like to strangle. Not strangle. To want to strangle someone. I'm not advocating strangling. Keep the precepts. Then you're honest. Then you know what's going on, right? And then you bear with that first, right? And then someone will say, well, you're just holding it. You know, you should forgive. Tell them to get out of the room and be with your own program. And then go with that. Then eventually you'll get to forgiveness. Because it's torture to hate. To hate is torture. But maybe you have to be honest with that until that energy runs its course. So don't be afraid of it. And if you're not narrating with a sense of self, it'll just be a tsunami. A tsunami of emotion, and you know, it'll have a lot of energy and say, wow, this is difficult. I should forgive. Well, wait. It all belongs. So what you're doing when you say it all belongs, now you're having true compassion to this feeling of wanting to murder someone. And it's considering what they did, yeah. Some people might say, go for it. I'm exaggerating. But can you see the point? What we're doing, stream of consciousness, is now enraged. In stream of consciousness, the feelings of rage, and now it belongs. So what comes in stream of consciousness is compassion. But if you make compassion an ideal rather than as a method, then it becomes this head trip that you try to suppress the anger with by, I should be compassionate. But that's not compassion. In the moment, there is anger, and it feels this way, and it belongs, and that's compassion. Right? And trust in that, and you can see that, okay, this is what we're talking about when we talk about love. I love my anger. No. It belongs. So it can sound very sentimental and smarmy. So if your programming has been to be a good boy or a good girl and forgive and all of that, then quite often you miss really what this is about. And then, but if you do that, then you'll get to forgiveness because you don't want to torture yourself. It'll come. Give it time. Make sense? Yeah? So help as much as you can, but don't be careful. Be careful not to get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. What are we doing? Can you explain the difference between presence and being in awareness? I think that's the same for me. Presence in awareness. I just use a whole bunch of language around that. Hopefully one hits. Presence is a very powerful word. Because you can't find presence, can you? Yeah, oh yeah, Christmas present. Not that. Presence. You can't find it, but it's always there. So it's a powerful word. The power of now. Eckhart Tolle is. It's very powerful, isn't it? Now is the knowing, Ajahn Sumedho. Stillness of being, boom. In awareness. What is all that pointing to? Right? Different ways of, and in different traditions. Rumi defines it as love. Well, that's too long. I think that's it for tonight. So I offer that free reflection.
Andamayang dhammakatha sadhukarang dadamase sadhu 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 anumodhami.
That's the best one yet.